Okay, the Finance Committee will come to order. Thank you, members, for coming. We have a presentation today from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on substance abuse, a report that was made in 2006, and we're going to hear from them shortly. But first, I would like our fiscal analyst, Gary Carter, to give us a brief overview of the summary budget, of the budget spreadsheet that we'll be working off of and for the next several weeks. So, Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, in your packet, or I guess in the budget book, you'll find copies of the spreadsheet, the first thing. Also, for members in the audience, this we can get you copies, and it will be posted on the fiscal website by this afternoon. Just want to let you know that the overall increase in spending that the governor is recommending from the forecasted base is about a 9.1% increase. If you look at what they're spending that's spending in 06 and 07, from the base, the current base, it's 8.28%. And I just want to highlight some of the areas. If you want to turn to the first page of the spreadsheet, for new members, the spreadsheet basically is going to have the governor's recommendations for the next biennium, which starts July 1st. It's also going to have TAILS numbers. The TAILS are the recommendations, the estimates for fiscal years 2010-2011. So the spreadsheet will show how the governor's recommendations are broken down by the agencies that we have. And just want to say that you also have the budget books now. I think the staff did a great job of putting these together. And for members, if you want information on the agencies, read the budget books. It's important. You're going to see the mission statements, the goals, something about the numbers pages, but also the change items. The change items are what the governor is recommending, some of the new spending that he is recommending. So we'll just start on page one, and that's should be in your budget book, the second page. And this is the sheet that we will be working off of as we, put together the budget, that this committee puts together the budget. You'll see that under the Supreme Court, that's the first agency, basically it's an increase of $5.1 million. And that also, the governor had to put it in one program, so he put it under state court operations, but that could also include civil legal services. Court of Appeals, you have an increase on that's on line 25 of almost $1 million, $996,000. And the district courts, it's a little over $28 million. And the governor doesn't really distinguish where the money should go for the courts. He gives them one lump sum because they're a separate branch of government, and he says we can let the legislature decide where that money will go. Tax court, there's two increases there on line 41 and 42 of the spreadsheet. And one is for maintaining existing functions. It's $111,000. And then there will be a compensation adjustment. We won't have to cover that. I'll cover it right now. It's all agencies. It's 2% a year. Corrections, with their correctional officers, they're going to have somewhat of a higher percent. And if there's any special revenue funds or trunk highway funds, if they're coming out of that increase will be about 3.25%, I believe. Uniform Laws Commission is the next one. That's on line 46, and that's a dues increase. And to make up for lost dues, this is our small agency. It's only $20,000. Board of Judicial Standards on line 51. You can see that there's going to be some increases there. One is to restore the base, and also the governor is recommending $125,000 a year to cover special hearing and investigation costs. They usually have a deficiency. I think he's trying to give them some base funding for this. And that total on that one is $387,000, and that's for the biennium. Public Defense Board, once again, no recommendation, but he's recommending, no specific recommendation, but he's recommending a lump sum of $7.5 million. On page two, We're going to get into the Public Safety Department. Here on line 71 under Homeland Security and Emergency Management, that's the first program under Public Safety, the governor is recommending disaster assistance of $500,000. Basically, they have $200,000 in their base. He's recommending an increase of $250,000 a year for that. And that's to cover disasters. That's to pay the state share, and that leverages, the state share is about 15%. That leverages federal money. The federal money comes in on these state disasters at 75%. Line 72, pandemic flu preparations. You can see that for the total for the biennium is $2.2 million. And I also believe that in the health department, there's a request of somewhere around $20 million for the flu pandemic preparation. Compensation adjustments, we covered that. We're going to skip down to line 82, which is the BCA. Here, the first one on line 86, the change item or decision item is CRIMNET. The governor is recommending $15.5 million for the biennium. And I think, Mr. Chair, you said there will be a separate hearing on CRIMNET. Line 87, the governor is recommending 20 forensic scientists for the BCA. You were through there the other day for a total of about $2.889 million. By the way, if you're just as a sidelight on this one, City Pages, I was reading it last night. You're having a hearing on St. Paul crimes in Minneapolis. I think interesting article on gangs in the City Pages. And they talk about DNA backlog of 9 months to get information from the BCA. Fire marshal, there's just a compensation change. And same thing with the gambling and alcohol enforcement. Those are some of the other programs. The other big program, this is their prevention program on line 117. This is the Office of Justice Programs. Here you're going to have the crime victims reparations. They will have an increase of $250,000 a year. Next is the Gang and Drug Task Force. This is an increase in state funding of $2.5 million a year on that's line 120. And that is to make up federal funds. They received that amount, they're losing in federal burn grants. Next is school safety centers. They want to start a program for school safety centers because of some of the school shootings. And the governor is recommending $200,000 a year or $400,000 for the biennium. This will also be in conjunction with the Department of Education. On line 122 is an appropriation for the victim notification system. This is $910,000. This is an existing program that lets individuals know when people are being released or when they're changing custody levels. It was also funded from internal funds and federal funds, so they need to make that up. We will skip then to page 3. The 9/11 emergency management 800 megahertz armor. Representative Cornish, I think you stated at one of the hearings you wanted that to go statewide. Well, it's going statewide now. And the cost of that is going to be close to $23 million for the biennium. However, there will be a cost to it, too, that the phone bills will now be going up if this passes in fiscal year 09 by 10 cents, fiscal year 2010 by 10 cents, and fiscal year 2011 by 10 cents. It's currently at 65 cents on each one of your phones. So that means at the end of fiscal year 2011, the fund will go from 65 to 95 cents. Next one, the other...
Representative Murphy?
And by 2011, the system will be throughout the state?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't know if it will be throughout the state. It is planned on being, I know they're going to start working on, you know, going statewide. I do not know how long it's going to take them. I think the chair said this also will be a special hearing on this program, and we'll get more information on it. They are right now in phase 3, that's the Rochester, Olmsted, St. Cloud area. that they're working on. And there will be six phases. Okay, the next big agency change will be for 156. We're going to skip over some of the smaller ones, but it's the 156, line 156 is the Human Rights Department. Their big change is a technology request. And you can see that it's for their case management system to update their databases. They're asking for $1.4 million the first year, and then with tails of $55,000 after that. Okay, corrections. That's the the larger agency, or the largest agency that this committee has jurisdiction over. We have some items here under institutions on line 168. That's to annualize the 06 session costs for about $4 million. And corrections, they were shorted in the tails amount. I think this was due to a tails target that the conference committee had. So they were shorted about $4 million, and this request will simply make up that amount. Next is an increase in health services for the biennium. That is $2.5 million. On line 170 is they want an increase in the governor is recommending an increase in the fuel and utility costs, and that is for $3 million for the biennium. Next is retiree insurance. They're saying there's more people retiring, plus the insurance is going up. They need, the governor is recommending there, a $1 million increase for the biennium. That is on line 171. And then we start with some of the offender reentry services on 172. The governor is recommending $800,000 for the biennium for reentry services. Next, we go to line 179. This is the second program in the Department of Corrections. It's community services. And the governor is recommending under community program costs a total for the biennium of $3.95 million. Basically, this is going to mean about 10 agents for the CIP program. I think we're going to go, have a trip up there in a couple of weeks. It's also going to mean the conditional release program was sunsetted, but they need additional funding because it was only one-time funding, so that's around $600,000. It's also money for the Interstate Compact, and there's some needs in their risk assessment community notification program. Next, we have the program of offender supervision in communities. This is one of the larger requests here. It's $17.15 million for the biennium. And I'm just going to go over some of those items quickly. From that, it's $600,000 a year for the CPO counties and the DOC contract counties. The CCA subsidy, which most of you are CCA counties, the governor is recommending $2.8 million every year. Sex offender management, there's a placeholder. I think this committee is going to receive a report on February 15th. It's a legislative mandated report on some items that they were to consider about sex offenders. We're hearing that there's going to be a cost for this. I think they're talking about possibly 40 more agents. And it's sort of like a placeholder for that. Also, there's some sex offender assessment money in there. And like I said, the total on that will be over $17 million for the biennium. Next, we have on line 184, sentence to serve. This is to maintain some of their, I think it's five or six of their programs at $600,000 a year. On line 185, you're going to see this is the short-term offender program. Now, the governor is recommending a $4.38 million increase into this. They're saying that's going to bring that per diem up. I think it's around $9 a day now, up to around $30. And I'm sure we'll have much discussion on that when the time comes. This is the other offender reentry services program. We heard some of this in Representative Mullery's committee the other day. The governor is asking for $2.2 million in community services for this program. And we just have the compensation adjustments. The last agency we have is the Sentencing Guidelines program. They're going to be asking for a few more staff because they lost staff with some of the budget cuts, and that's on line 209, and that's for $247,000 for the biennium. The other thing, members, on the bottom of that spreadsheet, I just want to highlight the deficiency recommendations. The governor is recommending 4 deficiency recommendations. And that is for this current fiscal year where they're running out of money this fiscal year. First one is for the tax court, and that's just to maintain current funding. He's recommending $47,000. The other one is for the judicial standards boards. This is for disciplinary proceedings. There's 2 cases, and the judges are demanding hearings, so that means investigative costs and attorney costs. So that is at $90,000. Then on the line 246, we have the public defense board. They talked about their deficit in transcript funding for the appeals division. The governor is recommending $200,000. The last deficiency request is the from DPS, Homeland Security Emergency Management. It's disaster assistance funding, and that is at $1.1 million. Those are still, there's still claims coming in from the Red Lake floods, so that will cover that. And once again, this matches the federal funds. Also, I just want to point out, in the other committees in bonding, there will be a request for Oak Park Heights. Representative Murphy, you're on that committee. You will, or the bonding committee, I believe. And they will have a bonding request for perimeter work and some ventilation system work.
Yeah.
That's a brief summary, Mr. Chair, of the governor's recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Any questions of Mr. Carter at this point? We're going to be going over all of that in great detail in the next few weeks.
Do you want to just wait until I'm done?
Since we have sort of a full meeting, I'd prefer, unless it's something real quick. Okay. Representative Biskins, did you have a question about the budget? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a request, if I could, Mr. Chair and the staff. One of the things that I'm finding a little difficult to read in this is what are new programs versus increase in funding in individual programs. Sometimes, in some counts, we list decision items, and to me, okay, that must mean there's increased funding, but is it a new program or etc. My request, Mr. Chair, is can staff redo these budget tracking sheets, which we're going to spend a lot of time with, all right, to back it up 2 years so that these budget tracking sheets can include actual 06 and actual 07 so we can make the bigger comparison. I know it'd probably force it to go to a landscape print, but that's okay because then I wouldn't have to turn my budget book upside down to look at it, all right?
Right.
So that could
we can work on this. Representative Fiskins, let me talk to you on that. We'll show you how this base is, and if there's a better way to do it, we can definitely do it. This committee has sort of like had a history of doing this, but, we can change.
Thank you, Representative Fiskins. Any other questions of Mr. Carter at this point? Okay, the chair notes that we do have a quorum, and I would ask Representative Eastland if he's had a chance to review the minutes of January 16th and the 23rd, and if you have, would you please make a motion to let the committee adopt those minutes?
I move it up.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We have the Office of Legislative Auditors report again. As I said, this was done in 2006. And for people who read these reports, I just think it's a good idea to have the folks who wrote them to come back and find out if their findings and recommendations have been adopted or where they're at. And so we'll have that opportunity today. So with that, I will turn it over to Joe Alter and Valerie. Is it Bomback? Okay. And take as long as you need, and then we'll have DOC and the Department of Human Services up following your presentation. And feel free, members, to interrupt if you have a question as they make their presentation. And that's it, Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and we really do appreciate coming back to this committee. We presented to many of you last year the findings of this study, but I think many of these issues we're going to talk about today are still very pertinent and timely, and we appreciate the opportunity. And I think most of you are familiar with our office. We are a nonpartisan research office of the legislature. I'd also add that we're waiting for the new Audit Commission members to be appointed from the House and Senate. Once that happens, they will be looking for new evaluation topics for the coming year. If there are programs, activities, agencies that are state-funded that you think are in need of an evaluation, that's what the Audit Commission will be turning their attention to in coming weeks. So until we hear who the new members are, feel free to contact me or Jim Nobles with the office, and we'll get ideas on the list. Today we're going to talk about this report we issued last year on substance abuse treatment. And in this evaluation, we looked at the outcomes of treatment to the extent that we could, but we also recognized that treatment is only going to have favorable impacts if people can get into it. And so we also looked at the process by which people get into substance abuse treatment and how those treatment options vary around the state. I'm going to start with just a little bit of background today on the system, both in the community and in the prisons. I think it's important to say that, first of all, on the community side, state agencies and counties both play key roles. Under state law, the Department of Human Services has primary responsibility for overseeing Minnesota's community-based substance abuse services. DHS licenses nearly 300 public and private service providers. Those programs serve a lot of criminal offenders around the state, but they also serve other people who have come to those treatment programs at their own initiative. Counties are, in effect, the gatekeepers of the system. They conduct assessments and make referrals of people to programs. They also contract with the service providers. On the prison side, the Department of Corrections is the lead agency. DOC conducts chemical use assessments when people come into prison and determines whether they should be referred to a particular treatment program. When inmates are getting ready to leave prison, DOC and the counties jointly do release planning for those offenders and determine if there are services that those offenders need at the time of their release to the community. A couple of words about funding on the community-based side. Again, treatment services in the community serve a mix of people, and some of those people are funded out of pocket or by private insurance, but the majority of community-based treatment admissions are ones that are funded by public dollars. The largest source of public funding is something known as the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. This fund pools together state and federal funding for treatment. Counties are also expected to pay a share of this treatment. But just to give you a sense of where the funding comes from, in 2006, the state funds paid for more than $60 million of the community-based funding, and that outnumbered the county expenditures by more than 3-1. On the prison side, most of the funding for prison-based treatment comes from the state, and in 2006, it totaled a little over $3 million. I should also mention that there is no separate funding when people come out of prison. There's not funding that comes through DOC and follows offenders into the community upon release. If offenders need to get treatment after they're released from prison, then they use the same sources that are available to other people in the community. If their incomes are low enough, they may qualify for funding from the Consolidated Fund, or they may have to pay out of pocket. Also, it's worth noting as background that state law contains policies that support the use of treatment in both community and prison settings. The law has a general policy statement that says that the interests of society are best served by treating chemically dependent persons. Consistent with that policy, state law also requires the implementation of rehabilitative programs in prisons for inmates. Next, I'm going to turn to what we found in this report regarding the community-based programs, and I'll return a little bit later to the prison-based programs. Mm-hmm. Regarding community-based treatments, we found that the use of publicly funded treatment by low-income people varies a lot around the state. And we looked at a variety of measures. I'm just going to touch on this fairly briefly today and focus on a couple of measures. But I'm not even going to pick out the most extreme examples that we saw in the state. But just to give you a couple of examples, I'm going to focus on a couple of suburban counties that are about the same population. fairly similar demographic profiles, Anoka and Dakota. And to use one measure, we looked at how many admissions to publicly funded treatment did adults in those counties have, and that's per 1,000 persons in poverty. Pretty wide variations between Anoka and Dakota, with Anoka making much more use of publicly funded treatment. Or to look at another example, this is looking at the types of treatment that that people were referred to. A minute ago we saw that Dakota made less use of treatment. They also relied much more on outpatient treatment than did Anoka. More than 80% of the people who went into treatment in 2003 and 2004 went to some sort of outpatient treatment. Anoka used outpatient a lot as well, but Anoka made much more use of other types of programs like halfway houses and inpatient programs. And so again, even controlling for the number of low-income people in these counties, we saw a lot of differences in these counties and others in the placement and referral patterns.
Mr. Alter, can we have one question at this point? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you also do some control or take into account, for example, that Anoka has Anoka State Hospital, so it's accessible and close by? I'm not familiar with what Dakota has in their area.
Mr. Alter.
Madam Chair and members, we didn't control for that. I think that probably is one of the factors that reflects Anoka's historical preference. I'm not sure that they use it nearly as much as they used to, but I think that that has been one of the historical factors that has led Anoka to make more use of inpatient placements. We also concluded, as we looked at the assessment and referral system, that these practices at the local level need a lot more oversight. State law requires the Department of Human Services to monitor local assessment practices, but DHS really hasn't done much of that in the last few years. Meanwhile, our report raises concerns about local assessment practices, and I'll briefly walk through some examples of that. Who gets assessed in various counties? There are some counties that will assess anyone who walks through the door and says, I need a chemical assessment, whereas there are some other counties who say, we will only assess those people whose incomes are low enough that they would qualify for publicly funded treatment. We found differences in the assessment instruments that counties are using, the types of questions they ask, which are things that will undoubtedly lead to differences in decisions at the county level. We saw differences in timeliness. We heard from some outstate counties in different parts of the state that said, it takes us 3 months from the time we refer someone to get an assessment until the time we actually get the results of that back. We saw some differences in the thoroughness of counties. There are some counties that routinely, as a matter of policy, will always, when doing a chemical use assessment, consult with a probation officer if the person has one and find out more about that person's past chemical use, whereas other counties don't do that. And then a final issue to note here, Minnesota rules define what chemical dependency is, but we've had an outdated definition for about 20 years in Minnesota. What I mean by that is that the definition that is in our rules is not consistent with the diagnostic manual that's used nationally for mental health purposes. New rules are scheduled to take effect in about a year, and my understanding is that those rules would require that the state would follow the current diagnostic manual. But again, it's been about 20 years since our definition has conformed to what is general practice nationally. I also want to talk a little bit about treatment availability, because this is another factor that can drive some of those differences in placement patterns. And just to give you, in a nutshell, some areas where we think there is treatment that is fairly readily available, and other areas where frankly, there are some real problems. Outpatient treatment is available in most parts of the state, even though there are differences in the extent to which counties make placements in outpatient. But most parts of the state have pretty good access to outpatient treatment. However, some of the longer-term or more intensive types of programs, like halfway houses and what's called extended care, those are much less easy to come by in some parts of the state. We heard from local officials that there are a lot of 12-step programs. They're generally satisfied with those types of programs in the community. In contrast, methadone maintenance programs for heroin users, we only have two in the state that are publicly funded. They're both in Hennepin County. There are some users of these programs that travel quite long distances to get to these programs for regular treatment. In general, local officials were fairly satisfied with the availability of programs for alcohol abuse. In contrast, a lot of local officials expressed a desire for better programs for methamphetamine users. And by that, they meant longer programs, programs that were more specifically focused on a criminal population, or sometimes just more beds in the facilities that existed. We've heard a lot about dual diagnosis clients, people who have both mental illness and chemical dependency, and the lack of programs that, specifically address that population. And we tended to hear more concerns about the lack of programs for adolescents compared with adults. Earlier I noted that the consolidated fund at the state level is the main source of funding for treatment, and appropriations for that fund have grown quite a bit in recent years. In 2000, the number of the amount of state funds for the consolidated fund totaled about $37 million, and that grew by 2006 to $63 million. But it's also important to note that in 2003, the legislature reduced the maximum income of people who are financially eligible to access that funding. Today, this fund covers people who have a poverty-level income or below. The fund used to cover people whose incomes were somewhat above the poverty level. Now, it's a little bit hard to know exactly what impact those 2003 changes had. But when we looked at a sample of people who were sentenced to felony-level probation in 2003 for felony-level chemical possession or use, we found that a fairly substantial number of those people were not going into treatment programs. And certainly one of the possible reasons could be eligibility. When we talked with local officials, they generally said, we see a lot more of our offenders who meet the income eligibility requirements to go into treatment. If they're not income eligible, a lot of times they don't. Next, turning to a couple of comments on treatment effectiveness.
I think we have a Representative Dominguez has a question, and then Representative Fiskins. And
on your back slide, the one you just previously, you know, the eligibility treatment funds, are those any culturally based programs?
Mr. Chair and members, this fund is not. I mean, this fund is essentially open to anyone who meets the income requirements. I'm trying to think, and maybe the Department of Human Services can comment, there may be some culturally specific funds that are from another source, but the main consolidated chemical dependency fund is not culturally specific. It is open to anyone.
Representative Biston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm interested in finding out how does the OLA define poverty level? You know, serving on K-12 education, that could be anything upwards around 250% of what the federal government says is poverty. So how does the OLA
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, we use the federal definition of poverty, and essentially the consolidated fund is available to anyone at or below 100% of the federal definition. I think there used to be what's called Tier 2 funding from the consolidated fund. I believe the eligibility went up to about 215% of the federal poverty level.
Thanks,
Mr. Alter. So prior to 2003, were there any income limits? Or,
Mr. Chair, it went up to 215% of the federal poverty level, and now it's at 100% or below of the federal poverty level.
And do we know how much it would cost to bring the fund up?
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be a good question for DHS.
I guess we have several more questions at this point. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is going to be, is that fund usually have enough money to fund those that do meet all the requirements, or does it tend to be under, or are there more people in line?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure we have a real good sense of that. I mean, it is interesting that the funding, as I mentioned, has grown overall a lot in the last few years, and during that time, we have, as a state, restricted eligibility somewhat, and yet we seem to be using the money. So are there people who are being turned away? I don't think we have very good data on that I've seen, but again, maybe the department has some sense of that. I don't think I've seen anything that's very hard quantitative data on that.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, I just back you up a little bit. One of our tours we had was to the Raymond Court, and just one of the clients was had a problem and spoke about the need for methadone or something like that. I just wonder if you could give just like a couple minutes of discussion about that program or something. You just kind of skimmed over it. And
Mr. Alter?
Thank you. And Representative Lilly, methadone is a drug, and it is used as a replacement for people who are on heroin or similar types of substances. And it has been somewhat controversial over the years because of that. There are some people who strongly believe that you shouldn't use drug as a part of drug treatment. But I will say, and we talk about this in the report, the literature on methadone maintenance as a treatment modality is very strong. It has been shown in a number of very good studies to be a very effective treatment, more effective than alternative treatments. And so, you know, it's something that there isn't a gigantic need for. The number of heroin abusers is not nearly as many as many other substances, but it is an important component of the treatment system out there.
So, Mr. Alter, how would, maybe this is a question for DHS then at some point, about are you recommending that they expand the amount of clinics that would dispense methadone to Mr. Alter?
Mr. Chair, this has been an issue that the DHS has worked on in recent years. I know they put out an RFP trying to get someone else in the state to be a provider, and didn't have much luck, but it's been a frustrating issue for them and for the counties because, as I mentioned, there are some people who come from parts of the state and travel long distances to go to the few available clinics that there are to get their weekly dose of methadone or whatever, and are driving literally sometimes hundreds of miles. So it has been an issue that DHS has raised and tried to address, but not with success so far.
Representative Lieberman?
I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a brief follow-up on the consolidated fund issue. Am I understanding right that there are no co-pays at all, and if a person doesn't qualify or over 100% of poverty, they just plain can't get any of the money?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that is correct, but I want DHS to correct me on that about whether there are co-pays. I believe not, but let's have them set the record straight on that for sure.
Representative Bigham and then Hillstrom, and then maybe we should let them finish their report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. In the slide here it says many persons sentenced to probation for substance-related felonies denied enter treatment. Is that because there's not enough beds? Is that because they're not sentenced to it? Did you guys look into that at all?
Mr. Chair and members, we don't know for sure the reasons. We looked at a sample population and then looked at the extent to which they got into treatment, and I believe it was about half that were not going into treatment after some fairly tough criminal offenses related to drug use or possession. Now, it could be true that that was not part of the sentence, and we didn't look into that. We didn't have those records at hand. But again, what we heard from local probation officials, corrections officials, was that generally for those people who are sentenced, they're much more likely to go into programs if they are income eligible. And so we do think that the restrictions on the consolidated fund are at least somewhat of a factor in the number that go into treatment.
Mr. Alter, you want to continue, please?
A few words about treatment effectiveness. And what the state rules say is that the goal of substance abuse treatment is to help clients change their harmful pattern of chemical use. Obviously, trying to measure the results of treatment is very difficult. It's hard to know for sure whether someone is using chemicals, especially after they've left the treatment environment. And it's hard to know for sure whether any improvements they make are due to treatment or due to other factors. There have been some very good studies that have been done, and we relied a lot on those rigorous, carefully conducted studies. We have an entire chapter of the report that's devoted to a review of the literature. And my main caution for you today is to be careful when you hear people offer generalizations. I've heard people say a blanket statement, treatment works. Or I've heard the exact opposite, and it's people who say nothing works, or yeah, treatment isn't effective. We all know that. The truth is there is a very mixed record out there in the good studies that have been done. There are studies that show that for certain types of treatment, that on average, there are favorable improvements of the people who go through those programs. But we can also say that treatment clearly does not succeed with all clients. And there are some commonly used types of programs that simply don't have very good track records. So again, I'll skip over this briefly. We have more discussion in Chapter 2 about types of programs that have been shown to work or not work as well. I will say that the literature has tended to show that programs that are effective have to be long enough, and they have to be tailored somewhat to the individual needs of clients. And as we looked at the duration of programs in Minnesota, and some people have suggested that programs need to be 90 days or longer to be effective, most of the programs in Minnesota are not that long, and this doesn't necessarily mean that the intensive treatment has to be that long, but what experts say is that there has to be some level of contact generally for treatment to be effective over an extended period. And we also heard concern from county officials that some of the providers in the state don't tailor their programs a lot to the needs of individual clients, let's say with mental health needs or other types of needs.
Longer the 90 days are recommended, is that inpatient or outpatient?
Mr. Chair, the kind of standards and the discussions that are taking place at the national level don't really distinguish. It could be a combination of the two, but generally there's a feeling that you have to have a long enough period of something to really change behavior, whether it's inpatient, outpatient, or a little of both.
I have one more question for you, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alter, since you raised this issue, did you compare this with national methods of treatment and what Minnesota is doing? The reason I'm raising this is a few years ago, I was at a conference and several people during, you know, long break, we were talking, and they said, Mr. Mullery, you should be happy and sad. You should be happy for the fact that Minnesota was the leaders in the 1960s and 1970s on the treatment of alcohol, and you should be sad because now Minnesota is one of the least advanced in the entire country on how to treat things. They don't realize that there's different methods, work with different people, and you really have a mess up there. Have you looked at these national treatment methods as compared to what we have? And
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Mullery. Earlier I noted that we have some holes in our treatment system, and I would say, you know, it's hard to say how we as a state compare with other states. I think we probably in many ways have resources that other states don't because of our history of places like Hazelden and the Minnesota model of treatment that have a long history. But I think that it is kind of easy to rest on our laurels too and assume that things are going well when, as we pointed out earlier, there's a lot of concern among county people that we don't have the right types of treatment for the types of people that are coming through the system, for adolescents or for meth users or some of the different types of needs that we're seeing out there today.
Just real quick follow-up, and not even a question. Could you, or would it be possible for you to do that type of a study of other methods around the country? Or maybe that would be some other department.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think it would be hard to find, I mean, it frankly is hard in Minnesota. We don't really have an inventory of programs that is very descriptive at the types of programs we have, and that's one of our concerns that we raise in this report. And I doubt that I'll bet there's a lot of other states that don't either, but, I mean, we raise this with the department, and the department is beginning to work on it, just trying to find out not just the names of the programs, but what exactly do they offer? What is their modality? What is the length of their program? Do they have mental health people on staff? It's hard to find that out right now if you're looking for programs. Finally, I want to make a point on information, because one of the frustrations that we have, but also that local people making placements have, is that there's not enough information out there. Our report has some information on some indicators, and I'm not going to go through exactly what we found, but just to say that these are some things that can indicate how well programs are doing. The extent to which people complete the programs they enter, the extent to which they are readmitted to programs, what the licensing reviews or peer reviews say about treatment programs. None of those is a magic bullet for saying how any particular program is doing, but those are the kinds of things that you want to be looking at to at least make some judgments about the quality of programs. And so, as I'll point out in a minute, we think there should be more of that information out there. In terms of our recommendation for community-based treatment, we suggest that DHS should be fulfilling its statutory obligation and doing monitoring of local agencies' assessment and referral practices. We think that DHS should propose a statewide strategy to this year's legislature about how it will improve access to effective and appropriate treatment and address some of those service gaps. I haven't talked about this, and it's an issue we raised in the report, but there's a funding issue related to the county share and some inequities that we think should be addressed. And DHS has done its own study with a task force and concluded that there are inequities that need to be addressed in the local shares as well. And finally, we think that there needs to be more information out there about the characteristics of programs, but also about program performance. And then for the legislature, and these are issues that were addressed last year in some bills that were moving through human services committees, but ultimately did not pass, and I would hope that the legislature revisits these issues this year. We think that there should be some time frames for chemical use assessments. We have them in statute right now for assessments related to DWIs, but not for the broader group of assessments. And right now, sometimes what you see is people end up in jail outside the resident county, and the home county doesn't want to come to that county to do the assessment, and so weeks and months can pass without an assessment being done. We think that there should be language in the general law that is similar to what's in law now for DWI assessment, similar to the requirement that's in law for DWI that requires contact with probation officers when the assessments are done. That requirement is not in law for chemical use assessments in general, and we think it should be. Next, I want to turn to prison-based substance abuse treatment.
Excuse me one second, Mr. Cornish.
Could you, Mr. Chair, could you back that up a slide or two, one more? Effective treatment, the second one there, your direction is we should propose a strategy for increasing access to effective treatment. At the end of this, are you going to give us an idea then? You had said you were going to give us an idea of some that worked. Can you give us an idea of what effective treatment is or which one that we should direct it towards?
Mr. Chair and Representative Corners, I think that's kind of an ongoing thing that I think DHS needs to monitor is what are the types of treatment being used? Are those the right types given the types of clients who are coming through the system? So I don't think there's any quick answer to what is. There are many types of treatment that can work with certain individuals, but I think that's an ongoing issue for DHS to monitor as it tries to expand treatment opportunities.
Mr. Alter, can you maybe finish up in the next few minutes so we can give DHS and DOC a chance to respond?
On prison-based programs, there were, at the time we did our study, two types of programs in the prisons. One is kind of treatment, real treatment. Last 6 to 12 months, as group and individual counseling, hadn't seen much growth in that in the last few years. And then DOC had seen a lot of growth in what were called education programs. Shorter term, not as intensive, didn't include any individual counseling, and again, that had grown a lot in prisons in the last few years. We looked at the extent to which individuals were getting into treatment and completing treatment who were chemically dependent in our prisons. And let me give you in a nutshell what we found. Of those people, we looked at the people who were released from prison in 2004, did they get into treatment? We found that 17% of the chemically dependent prison population had completed treatment at the time they were released from prison. 9% had entered treatment but didn't complete it. 30% had gone into one of those education programs, which again are not really a treatment program, and the remaining 45% had not participated in treatment or education programs at all. In addition, we found that for those chemically dependent offenders leaving prison, relatively few entered treatment upon release. Less than 10% entered a treatment program within 6 months of release. I mentioned that there are release plans that are done for offenders at the time they leave prison. Our conclusion was that often those release plans didn't have enough guidance to the local supervising agencies about what those offenders needed, and that many of the probation agencies were not very satisfied with the information they were getting on offenders, like what treatment they had been through or what assessments had been done. The last issue I want to talk about is what happens to those offenders when they leave prison. who are chemically dependent. Again, we looked at the extent to which there were new arrests or convictions of those people who in prison had been assessed as being chemically dependent. Among inmates deemed chemically dependent by DOC, first I want to talk about those who quit or were terminated from a prison-based program. This is where we saw the highest recidivism rates. For example, 65% were rearrested within 3 years. The next highest recidivism was among those who essentially were an untreated population. They hadn't gone through a program at all. And then somewhat lower for those people who completed some sort of prison-based education or treatment program. Now let me break down that last category just a bit because I think it's interesting. There are different types of programs out there. And we saw the lowest recidivism rates for people who had gone through the Challenge Incarceration Program, which combines a boot camp environment with some chemical dependency treatment. It had really very low recidivism rates compared with the other programs we looked at. The other treatment programs within DOC had somewhat higher reoffense rates, and then the highest recidivism rates were in the short-term education programs. Now, I should mention that in the last year, and DOC can say more about this, DOC has converted most of its short-term education programs to treatment programs. So hopefully some steps are being taken to try to address this, but clearly there were some issues with the short-term education programs and the results with the offenders coming out of those. I think we have to be careful to jump to the conclusion that challenge incarceration is best. I mean, clearly there is some self-selection there too. So those offenders can volunteer for that program, and perhaps they aren't getting as difficult offenders as some of the other treatment programs are having to deal with. A couple things that the legislature did last year that we appreciate, that were consistent with our recommendations. The legislature required DOC to provide better information to the supervising agencies, and DOC the legislature required release plans to address offenders' needs more directly at the time of their release.
Mr. Alter, just 1 second, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this is a question for Mr. Alter for DOC, but on slide 18, the no prison-based program, the recidivism rates, 36% new conviction for serious offense, 60% a new arrest. Do you have information about the individuals incarcerated who are not identified as chemically dependent and what their recidivism rates are?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that handy. We did a study a number of years ago, and I can get back to you on that.
I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Yeah, or if DOC has that when they come up, if they could just address that, I'd be curious to see the difference.
Mr. Chair, finally, I just wanted to emphasize what we recommended to DOC because I think some of these are still very pertinent. We think that there is a need for additional treatment beds, and the Department of Corrections has said this for years. I don't think there was a request in the budget this year, but I'd like DOC to talk about this some more because it has been an issue. We also think that DOC should develop strategies for improving post-release outcomes, for working with local agencies, and I know that DOC has added a couple of staff to try to work on release planning and improve that process. And finally, we think there needs to be more monitoring of recidivism on an ongoing basis. So I think I will wrap up there. Again, we think there are some things that continue to be issues in the system that need to be addressed, and we appreciate your attention today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Alter. It was a very thorough report, and there's much more in here that we could talk about if we had time. Representative Dominguez, we're going to turn it over to DHS to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any breakdown data research as far as ethnic breakdown categories? Who's receiving services that need to be rendered?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to look briefly because I think in the early part of our report, we have a chart, and I can't remember if it has like the one thing we don't have in the chart on page 12 of the report is we don't have the race and ethnicity breakdown. And I think that had to do with we weren't confident in the categorizations that were in the statewide data, which are often an issue, I think, in race and ethnicity. But we've seen some data on that. The department may want to say more about that. I know there is some data. How good it is, I think, is a matter of some discussion.
Thank you again, Mr. Alter. And why don't we hear now, I think this is Deborah Moses from DHS. I'm thinking that we're probably, why don't you come up, and if we can't get all of DOC's responses today, we're going to be spending time on their budget next week, so we could we can expand this discussion next week. Ms. Moses, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Hi, I'm Deborah Moses. I'm the operations manager in the Chemical Health Division of the Department of Human Services.
Welcome to the committee, and I don't know how you want to address this, but obviously the auditor has made some specific requests and recommendations to your department, and where are you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will start. I put together, we've known the recommendations, obviously, for a year, and we're happy that we have been aware of the concerns in the chemical health field throughout our state for all along. That is our job, is to address issues within chemical health, and we've been working on many of these issues prior to the report coming out. But we're also happy to say that we have made a lot of progress since the report has come out, and I know that you've asked questions along the way. I'll go through my response first, and then I'll come back to some of the questions that have been asked, and then open it up for questions, if that's all right, Mr.
Very good.
We had to prioritize initially with no-cost remedies, as well as trying to reallocate funds because we were not given additional funds to address these issues. And again, we have been well on the way already to meet a lot of them with our existing priorities. The first recommendation, one of the big recommendations, was to distribute information to chemical health assessors on best practices. This responds to the need and specifically as well to adolescents. This responds to the need to make sure there is appropriate placements. We have been in the process of rewriting our Rule 25, which is our assessment placement criteria rule. In that rule, as Mr. Alter suggested prior, there have been discrepancies throughout the state with different counties doing assessments differently. We will mandate a tool that will be mandated from the Commissioner of Human Services for all counties to collect information on the same tool and to use the same placement criteria throughout the state. We've been working with statewide with the county placements, with the different communities of color and American Indian communities, with the tribes, and with adolescent services to make sure this tool is appropriate statewide, meeting the needs of rural and urban, as well as the different cultural populations within our state. So that's in the process right now. That will be implemented January 1st of 2008. The rule itself will go through public hearing sometime this summer. We've also been asked to increase our monitoring with local agencies about the assessment and referral rules. I will be interviewing this afternoon for a research scientist. One of the things that we really need to do in our monitoring is to assess baseline of how monitoring practices take place. We have to look at prevalence along with placement, how placement is being happening, what placement practices are by county. And getting prevalence throughout the state isn't as easy as it sounds. We look at DWIs, we look at different criteria, but different counties even do that differently. So we have to work with human services and get those baselines and then make a determination. We do know there's uneven practices throughout the state, and the main job of this research analyst scientist will be to determine how that's taking place and how to baseline our monitoring for that issue. We also have been told that the information is not good for placement authorities. The way it works is that our treatment system is a free market system. Programs get contracts with the counties, with the local counties, and from that, any county can use a contracted program based on a different county's host county agreement. So a county can use a provider outside of their county, but that's where they need the clear information of what each of those providers provide. We currently have a system that DHS uses for their directory called, it's a DHS online system called Minnesota Help. We have all of our programs on Minnesota Help at this time, all the licensed treatment programs. We've been working with placing authorities and assessors statewide to find out what information would be the most useful to get on that directory. And we have key indicators that they've come up with. We'll be surveying the providers, we'll be surveying counties. We'll also, right now, be looking at the indicators such as philosophy and things that have already been brought up. But we'll also be looking at how we can put some of that outcome data on there as well, much as has been done with the nursing home report card. Some of those indicators for outcomes that were talked about was readmission. We do have the readmission information. We'll be looking at how we're going to get that out to the placing authorities. This system will also be available for consumers. So when they are out looking for treatment for their families, they can have an idea prior to going to an assessment of what it is that that's out there and what's available. We're also looking at some of the other indicators by working across departments to get our data to work together to see if we can match treatment completers with offenses with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and other departments. So we're working on getting better data in that respect by working together. As far as the MOE goes, there was a recommendation made to make the maintenance of effort equal across states. We did bring together a task force of statewide representatives to look at that issue. They made a recommendation. We have put recommendations forward. That has not made it into the priority of the governor's budget. We do believe it's good policy, but at that time it does not fall out in the entire state's priorities for fiscal needs. So that's where that comes. That would be a big cost to the state. It would, for the upcoming biennium, it would be a cost of about $6.5 million, and then that cost would grow because it was a decrease of the recommendation is a decrease over 7 years of the MOE until it comes down to 15% across states. So we do have that analysis and the fiscal analysis of that available for that time period if someone would like that. We also had a recommendation to look at brief interventions. Joe Alter talked a lot about looking at best practices and evidence-based practices. Brief intervention is one of those, and there was a direct recommendation to look at that. The federal government in the last couple months have just allowed brief interventions to be funded through MA dollars. We are working to get that put into our health plan, and we've also been working with many of the healthcare organizations, Health East, Allina, Park Nicollet, to talk about how we can better integrate behavioral health services into the managed care organizations. Also with best practices, we have put out RFPs. We have increased the number of slots for women receiving children receiving treatment with their children. That is an evidence-based practice. It is also best practice. We've increased that through our grant funding. There was discussion earlier about culturally specific programs. We do provide grant funding to improve and increase the number of culturally specific programs throughout the state through an RFP process. We've also provided statewide training on motivational interviewing. Motivational interviewing is also an evidence-based practice. It's found to help clients engage in treatment better, and we open that training up to providers across the state. By the end of the year, 1,000 providers in chemical health and mental health will have received that training, and that will continue into the next year where we expect to train another 1,000 providers as well. As far as publicizing outcome data, we have improved our data collection system. It is now on the web as of November. We changed that data collection system to include variables that have been required by the federal government through the national outcome measures, as well as some of the recommendations made from the Federal Access to Recovery Program. Through that, by having that online, we'll have more data in real time and be able to analyze it better and see how our treatment programs are doing in a much faster way than we have in the past. We also, the licensing division is now putting, has on the website, it's just beginning and it's coming on slowly, all licensing problems that have been found within all licensed programs, not just chemical dependency programs. So counties will have access to that, any placing authority, and they'll be able to see any public citations that a treatment program has had on the web. So those are the ways we've addressed the recommendations at this point. I'll go back to some of the questions that were asked. I began to address the culturally specific question. I'd like to add that we have funding particularly set aside for the tribes. The tribes do not pay a maintenance of effort for American Indian placements, so that's one way that we ensure that the tribes and our American Indian population has access to treatment. We also, in our placement criteria rule, allow for anyone that's appropriate for a culturally specific placement has the right to ask for that placement. They don't have to have a culturally specific placement, but if that's what the client prefers, the county is mandated to place them in a program that meets their culturally specific needs.
One second, Ms. Moses.
I'm in no hurry if I can.
Okay. I'm done with my report. I'm just trying to get back to some of the questions that were asked. There was a question asked about sliding fee. There is no sliding fee scale or no copay in the CCDTF system. Prior to it going to 100% of poverty or below, when it went up to 250%, there was a sliding fee scale involved at that time as people's income gradually increased. We have, even though the criteria has lowered, the amount of placements in the consolidated fund has continued to go up every year. I think that question was asked as well.
Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chairman, then for some of your real successful treatment, what specific incentives do you are allowed? Maybe it's a better question for Department of Corrections or something, but like the challenge program that seems to be successful, is it just a sign-up sheet, come take this course and wear the uniforms and get your butt kicked around the prison yard? Or not too many people are going to volunteer for that, but is there any incentives like early out, special privileges, anything like this that would encourage them to sign up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, that really would be a question for the Department of Corrections as to how they operate those incentives.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Moses, I just want to know, when we're talking about access, we're all familiar with people getting to these treatment programs through the criminal justice system in some way. You know, they're on probation and they're one of the conditions in AD is to be treated or something like that. But could you just, other than the criminal justice system, how else are people kind of getting to these programs?
Moses.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Each county has staff on site. The state appropriation goes through counties, and the counties are responsible for administrating the consolidated fund. Each county's department, they're either human services or health and human services, are usually what they're called, have what we call Rule 25 assessors. Those are people that have been trained and are able to get people in to access the consolidated fund. So anyone has access to get to those assessors. At that time, they determine their eligibility for treatment as well as whether or not the fund will pay for treatment. And also, earlier was talked about the timelines and how we don't have timelines in our existing rule for how long those assessments need to take place. Our proposed rules to be started in January of 2008 do include timelines that counties, whether or not someone is in jail or in the community, will have to meet those timelines to give an assessment. We do have they're done pretty well throughout the state. And when we talk about the discrepancies, there's only a few counties here and there that have not provided quick access to treatment through the consolidated fund.
Follow-up, Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Moses, well, what I'm really kind of thinking about more is, you know, how does a person in the community even know about Rule 25? I mean, I'm kind of familiar with that through the criminal justice piece, but, you know, if somebody's, for example, on MFIP and somebody says, oh, maybe you have a chemical issue, I mean, how do people get there in the first place?
Ms. Moses?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if they look for chemical health treatment, chemical dependency treatment, if they call a treatment program directly, they're going to ask them what funding sources they have, and they're going to direct them to the county. If they go through MFIP, certainly the social workers at the county know about the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. One area we've been working very closely with. We do work with MFIP on what's called Integrated Services Project, which is a statewide project to better integrate chemical health services into MFIP, because clearly as MFIP has grown and people have gone into sanctions and other things, a large percentage of people left on MFIP are chemically dependent or mentally ill. So we have been working with MFIP. We've also been working closely with the child welfare system, with the Child Justice Initiative, alcohol and other drugs, to let both judges and child welfare workers across the state know how to access treatment. So we do work on that throughout the year, and it's something that we see important, that people do know those access points.
Ms. Moses, I mean, we're talking primarily now Rule 25, MFIP. We're talking about low-income people accessing the fund and having the counties pay, but, you know, not everyone who has a substance abuse problem is low-income. And what the auditor's report didn't address, and I'm wondering if you can, is it seems to me that insurance companies make it very difficult for a person with a chemical dependency problem to get into treatment, inpatient treatment. I know a personal example in my family where, you know, it was an unbelievable struggle to get someone into inpatient treatment with good insurance. And to me, it's the providers, insurance providers, that are putting an obstacle for people getting in. Do you have a comment on that and how we can change that?
Mr. Chair, you know, we clearly don't have any jurisdiction in that area. The only thing we have jurisdiction over is the licensing of treatment programs which private funders use. But at this point, I mean, the one access point we have is we work closely with the managed care organizations that are PMAPs. And for our clients, they have to give them the same access that would be provided through the Consolidated Treatment Fund. So they get information education through that way, but their commercial products are not something we have any control of. And often people have commercial health products without chemical health coverage even in that product. So we do know it's an issue, but it's not an area currently we have any jurisdiction over, and I'm not sure what the solution would be as for the concern.
And I'm sorry, during your testimony, did you comment on the recommendation that you were to provide a report to the legislature for improving availability of community-based substance abuse treatment?
I did not comment on that. I will say that we had put forward some recommendations to the governor's office, and again, it did not make it into the priorities. We're not clear from our division and the department what exactly the legislature would want. We're certainly willing to put together any type of report that you would like, but we would need more specifics. It was kind of a broad recommendation, and we were not sure what factors would need to be put into that and what would you would want that to include.
Mr. Alter, can you clarify that? You made the recommendation in the report.
Mr. Chair, I think the issue here is that we have some access problems in the state and other issues that need to be addressed, and DHS is essentially the state agency that provides the leadership on this issue, and we specifically, you know, left it fairly open, but we thought that These are some broad issues that aren't going to be solved overnight, but at least DHS should provide us with some sort of a blueprint about where we headed and how can we get there and what would be required in terms of funding or other actions. And so that's, you know, we didn't define exactly what that should include, but we thought it should come back and have that discussion with the legislature.
Ms. Moses, can you do that, or do you need resources?
We can do that. Again, and it's helpful to know what the priorities of the legislature are, but if it's just to meet, you know, we can put together our plan to improve access, and that's, if that's the biggest issue, or the... Clearly, when we look statewide, access is not as much of an issue for us as outcomes. We have good access and to chemical dependency treatment. And in fact, we have very little disparities in access to chemical dependency treatment as other health services have. We do see disparities in outcomes, and we could provide a report of how we see, of what the outcomes we have are, and then how we're working to improve that. Would that be?
That would be helpful as a start. Okay. Representative Mulder, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moses, do you have an analysis of all of the programs and how effective they are, how efficient they are, how many do they take, is each program adaptable to the many different types of treatments now that have been found to be effective around the country, or are they still in, some of the programs I understand are still in the old model that you have to fit into this cookie cutter thing, and if you don't, tough, and do they treat people in these programs, do they know how to treat them differently? In other words, I've read some studies that say some people are best cured of alcoholism by just being really tough on them and you can't break once and things like that. Other people, that affects their personality and reverse happens. They can never be overcome the problem if you force them into that. So do you have those types of analysis of which programs can do these different things and be effective?
Ms. Moses?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we have, you know, it's very hard to, and Mr. Alter touched on it earlier, to really define effectiveness and efficiency. We can give you completion rates and readmission rates. We do know that there's different models of treatment, and each model has their own place in the continuum. So one model might not do something that one program might not do something that a different program might do. We do not have as much of the continuum as other states have. We do, you know, Mr. Alter talked earlier about methadone maintenance programs. We would like to see more pharmaceutical interventions used throughout the state, maybe some more longer-term individualized treatment, again, some step-downs from inpatient to outpatient. And what we've been doing in that respect, and to say we're not there. We have, in the metro area, there's a much broader range of services available, and you can find those services. Once you get out state, you have less and less modalities available. And we're working to do training. With our new rules, treatment will have to be individualized. We will no longer be referring just to an exact treatment program, but rather to the needs of that individual. So the treatment programs and our rule that governed treatment programs changed in 2005 to open treatment programs up to be more able to be that individualized type of treatment. At the same time, we're doing training with the counties, who are the placing authorities, to let them know what to look for in a treatment placement and to be working with their providers to make sure they're meeting the needs of our two rules when they come together. So currently, I would not be able to give you a report about the broad spectrum. We could tell you what types of programs as far as how many are inpatient, outpatient, extended care, halfway house. We do not know the philosophies of all our programs. We do have sheets on all of them, and we could do kind of a narrative analysis, but I don't know if that would help. But we could also give you completion rates and readmission rates as well.
Mr. Chairman, just as a quick follow-up, I wasn't quite sure. Are you saying that you're going to require each program to be able to be adaptable to the different types of treatment needed by each individual? Or I thought you said that first, and then I thought you said the opposite. So,
Ms. Moses?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, with the new rule, the placement will be made based on that individual's needs rather than what the treatment program says they provide. So that it'll be based on the individual's severity defined along six dimensions, which is standard national criteria. Mr. Alter also talked about how we haven't been using national criteria. They will be assessed using the DSM-IV diagnosis, and then their placement criteria will be based on their individualized needs using best practice criteria. That treatment program will get that assessment, and they'll have to work with that individual's goals in each of those areas as identified at their placement.
We're running out of time, members. We have a few people who have questions. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you might have answered my question a little bit, but just to follow up here, my question is about follow-up. What do you have in place right now that follows up the programs that you see may be working, may not be working, may meet some criteria that needs to be developed, research data, what have you? Do you have anything in place now that follows the programs through? I know you have some contractual obligations there. So how do you follow those to see if those programs are working?
All licensed...
Moses?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, all licensed programs in the state have to complete what's called our DANE system, which is the Drug and Alcohol Normative Evaluation System. And that's required in our licensing rule. Because of that, we have more information than most states, because most states only require that information on their publicly funded clients. So we do get information from every licensed treatment program at intake, and now we've changed it. We also get it at 2 months if it's a longer-term treatment program, and again at discharge. We do not get information after the treatment stay. After the treatment stay, the only individual information we can get is by doing data matching with some of our other departments to look at through unique identifiers, have these people reenter the system in other ways. Have they come back to treatment is an easy one for us, but also have they reentered the correction system or other systems.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my questions have kind of been answered. Representative Mullery was on the same track. I just got a couple of questions. How big is the budget of the consolidated program?
It's currently around $100 million, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Eastman.
I'm reading in the report here that you license about 300 substance abuse treatment programs a year.
Ms. Moses?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
And I think, Mr. Chair, I think the issue is about how that process works are what kind of puzzle me a little bit, that we could have that many treatment providers out there and have that little oversight over what they're doing when it's all state funded. And I guess the one question that I have, you said you get quite a bit of data. We're developing best practices, and we're trying to get a better handle on the kind of treatment that works and that sort of thing. Is there any evaluation requirement for licensed providers to be able to provide information back so we can understand more about the recidivism kind of things?
Ms. Moses?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the requirement for evaluation of all licensed treatment programs is that they complete the DANE system, that they enter all their data into that system. And it's a pretty comprehensive system as far as the type of client that comes in, which is also very important because treatment stays and treatment results really depend on what the client's functioning was at the time of entering treatment. Then their progress at 2 months, if they're there more than 2 months, if it's a shorter program than that, at discharge, and then if it's a longer program, every 2 months until discharge. So that's when we get the information, and they are required to to include that. That includes information about education, employment, subsequent arrests. But again, it stops at discharge of the program.
Representative Eastland, real quick.
Mr. Chair, then one of the things we don't have is any real reliable data on the effectiveness of these programs, any of them. over a longer period of time after discharge. I mean, we have nothing.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did do a very comprehensive study, and I can't remember the year of that. I think it was 2001. That was the last one? 1996, I'm sorry. The years go by fast. But that was a very comprehensive study, and in fact, it's a study that's cited throughout the country often on treatment outcomes. It's a very costly venture to put forward. It takes a lot of time and money, and so we do often look at studies in other parts of the country to see what we can learn about effective treatment. Currently, there's very good research coming out of UCLA in California because of their Proposition 36, where they've mandated everyone into treatment. And so we used some of the other studies in other states, as many people had used ours, to surrogate measures for success. And from those studies, we do find treatment completion to be a strong surrogate for success as a measure, as well as readmission. So that's what we base our evaluation on.
One short. Okay, you have the last word, Representative Eastman. We're going to continue this on Tuesday because we have questions that people still have. And Representative Eastman,
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's interesting that, I mean, if we spend $100 million a year, and if we just do a simple calculation back to 1996, we sent $1 billion since the last. If things have stayed roughly the same in today's dollars since the last evaluation, and the evaluations that we're looking at still don't tell us if our programs are working. They don't tell us if the programs that we're licensing here in our state are working. And I find that a little bit concerning that we're spending those kind of dollars providing programs, to help people, and we're not making the investments necessary to know that they work. I just think that's concerning to me. That's a comment. You don't have to respond.
Representative, I do want to say that I believe the measures we are collecting while people are in treatment and the data matching are giving us a good picture of how our treatment programs work and whether or not they are working. That study did establish a baseline of knowing what to look at and what to look at for success. And again, we're able to look at other studies to look at what variables are important. And I think that we have come up with a cost-effective method of measuring success throughout our treatment programs throughout the state. And we do put a lot of effort into that system, the DANE system. So it's not that we're not evaluating our treatment programs. We're not doing the follow-up evaluation, which that evaluation is very hard to do and very costly. So that's why we look at those base studies to give us the surrogate measures.
Ms. Moses, thank you for your testimony. I apologize to the DOC for not getting to your portion here. What we'll do is next Tuesday finish this discussion and have the DOC respond to the legislative auditor's recommendations, if that's okay, and then we'll get into the DOC's budget. Just a couple, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If the auditor has suggested that the DHS is not totally monitoring the effectiveness, why doesn't the chair schedule a hearing and have representatives from all 300 providers come in and testify as to their effectiveness and let the committee judge their validity in the existence of the food chain of this budget? Huh? Just a friendly suggestion.
Chair, we'll take that under advisement. Let me just make an announcement about tomorrow, members, because I think most of you are planning on going on the tour. We are leaving promptly at 12:30 at the front of the state office building. We'll be back hopefully about 4:45. Please bring identification with you. No tobacco products, no cell phones are allowed. If you bring a cell phone, you'll have to check it, so you won't be able to get into the prison with it. And no weapons, Representative Cornish, I'm reminded, that are allowed inside the security perimeter. Please take your budget books with you. Next week, we'll be spending all of our time on most all of our days on the Department of Corrections. And I want to also remind you about a joint hearing that was scheduled with the Senate, our counterparts in their committee, with Senator Higgins, Tuesday, January 6th at the Capitol at 6 o'clock. February 6th. And we will have Mayor Coleman and Ryback and the two chiefs of police, and we're basically going to have a discussion about crime in Minneapolis and St. Paul and what we might be able to do about it. So I hope that all members can attend. Please adjourn.